Hello, and welcome to the ADH Deep Dive, the show that's not about ADHD, but is filled with proof it exists. We have a particularly large episode for you today, and I actually say we in that I'm actually here with Nikolai Van Steenis, serving as my Sherpa, my little emotional support dog on this episode. Talk about imposter syndrome. We're going to be talking with a friend of ours that we kind of sort of can't believe is our friend. He's kind of doing some incredible things in the rock and live music world that we kind of put in that little aspirational bucket of ours. But first, hi, Nick. Hi.
What's up, buddy?
Baby. Hi, baby boy.
Congratulations on, what, 10 days since the short film launch?
10 days since the short film, and I can look in real time. When last I spoke on the podcast, I said it had, and this was Saturday, I was like, oh my gosh, I think we're going to do it. We might get to 700 before Monday. And when last I checked, and I'm doing that right this second, Penelope currently has 1,533 views, 78 likes, and it's receiving the last 48 hours is... Dude, I think it's going faster than YouTube has time to calculate, because I just posted that the last 48 hours updating real-time live had like 480-some views. Mm. It now says 857 in the last 48 hours.
That's, dude, yesterday, like last night at probably, what, 6, 7 o'clock, you called me and you're like, hey, we're going to break 1,000.
We're going to do it, dude.
Probably this time yesterday. No.
Overnight, we've gotten about 600 views since then.
Exponential growth, man. That's sweet. Thank you to everybody that's given us support and shared it around and said nice things about it, man. It helps so much. Like,
I'm hoping that by this time, I think in theory, right now as of recording this, it's Tuesday. But I think as of recording this, I hope that by Friday the behind the scenes is out. My reservation was like, or I think our reservation was, let's wait until it loses steam. And then it didn't look like it was losing steam. It looked like it was growing faster. So it's like, okay, then let's wait until 1,000. Well, I thought 1,000 was going to be like next week or so. But it happened overnight. So we're going to have to do it.
I'm proud of us for setting low and realistic standards and expectations with this. Because every time something is exceeded, it feels so much better.
It feels good. And like, I've talked about it multiple times on the podcast. But why don't you go ahead and talk about what your expectations were before actually releasing it? Your hopes.
I mean, like, we like put our real asses into this, and I, in recent years, have kind of primed myself to not get super disappointed if it's not super well received or anything, because algorithms are tricky, and it's really hard to just even get your product in front of somebody. But I think our 24-hour thing was like, if we break 100, we'll be super happy.
Yep.
And yeah, we blew right through that, and
I mean, it's
I'm excited and still trying to maintain a level of realism and expectations and stuff, but just watching how quickly it's starting to climb and stuff, it's really cool. It's great.
And like, again, like setting those expectations was really important for us, because I would have been happy if we got 100 in the first 24 hours. And then we were like, okay, it's probably going to slow down because our friends will stop watching at that point. So we're hoping by like the end of the week, maybe we'll get 200. And then by that point, we had well crossed 600. And the coolest thing about this now is that it's not just our friends and family that's sharing it. It's the algorithm that's picking it up. And that's been the battle for so long.
And comparing it to like, I mean, we've only really ever released, well, I mean, you've done other creative stuff, but I've really only ever released music. And it's such a different beast in the sense that, you know, you're really just expecting your friends and family to share it, and then it kind of stops
You're
there.
Hoping that your friends and family
It typically stops there, though, whereas this, you know, it's already ran the gambit with our social media following, and it's just organic reach at this point. It's so cool.
Yep. I would argue that my friends and family are now annoyed with me sharing it. Dude, maybe that's only in my own head.
Can't stop, won't stop, man.
No, hell no. Well, I think with that, we could just say one last pitch. Sorry about the coffee gulp right there. If you have not yet, youtube.com/@DavidJMund, our short film Penelope is out now. It's qualified. We have listed it as a thriller slash horror. But, you know, it's YouTube friendly, so go into it with those expectations. If you're not a horror fan or not a thriller fan, this is just a short indie to support your homies, okay? So youtube.com/@DavidJMund, check out Penelope. And before we get into it, check out Life or Visuals, Nikolai himself. He's been, you know, I was going to use a word that you probably can't use these days, but he's been busting his ass on that edit, or was busting his ass on that edit to get it out in a timely fashion. And, you know, the dividends are clearly paying out. So, all right. Well, with that, I think it's time to invite in our pal. I guess the smallest teaser that I can give, maybe Nick can kind of break him down a little bit more simply. But we have a friend named John Eberhard, who we met, 2012, 2013, something like that?
Somewhere in there, yeah. It was a few years into LFT.
Yep, we were, and we'll talk about this a little bit on the podcast, but we were looking to record a new single. We had kind of headed a different direction musically, and we knew that we needed a different producer than where we had gone to record our EP or our other previous single. And we met John. He was one of, I believe we were the first project he ever produced.
Yeah.
And now he's in one of the biggest rock-adjacent bands, arguably, if not in the country, maybe in the world right now.
One of them.
The top three streams on their Spotify have close to 100 million on each one. We're going to be talking to John Eberhard of I Prevail. This is the part of the podcast where I feel like both of us can be humbled, right? In that we can talk about our, like, humble beginnings, especially Nikolai and I were kind of chatting about, like, early days with, like, LFT and how we met. But on the other side of humbling, I got to come right out and say it, right? Rip the bandage off. I don't listen to a ton of I Prevail.
Okay.
So I'm not as familiar with the music that you have. What I want to talk about more specifically is like what it's like to be a musician and a person who deals with the creative struggles. And the fact that you're in I Prevail just so happens to be crazy. Of course, I'm aware of you as a band, but that's also why I wanted to bring Nikolai in, because I feel like he is more well-versed when it comes to not only that genre, but like I just re-entered music for the first time in 10 years and Nikolai has stuck with it throughout all this time. So I think that it'll help sort of relate a little bit, but that's where I sort of put Nikolai on the spot, or whoever would like to sort of take it. You just got back from a pretty massive tour, correct? To what degree? Yeah. To what degree, Nikolai, were you aware of this? Like, oh yeah, go ahead.
Well, first of all, what's up, John? And I think the last time we were together, it was probably a month before you left for Europe. So, I mean, went from sitting in Cadillac, Michigan, and then I see you in front of thousands and thousands of people. Like, what was that first, like, walk on stage like?
Dude, I was terrified. we did the first show in Denver. So before we went to Europe, we did a U.S. run with Godsmack they did. Right. And the first show that I played with them was in Denver, Colorado. And yeah, I think they said there was like 10,000 people or 11,000 people there. And Jesus. Yeah, I was a nervous wreck, man. Like I come from a very small background of performing experience. Like I've only played, like prior to that, I had only played a few shows at a very, very small scale. So this was like, this was very different for me. So yeah, before I went out, I was definitely a nervous wreck. And then like, as I played a few shows with them, I got used to the sort of like the feeling of performing and like the adrenaline and all that. And it became a little less daunting. I still get nervous, don't get me wrong, but
even those guys probably still get nervous. Like
that's good to hear, because we're going to go into some of those as specifics. Cause like, that's kind of the stuff that I like breaking down a little bit, is the fact that like, as we get better, clearly we can look at like what we did 10 years ago and be like, we didn't know what we were doing, but we were still just as afraid and just judged ourselves just as harshly as we do now when we're actually talented. So like, knowing full well that I've seen pictures of you playing to seas of thousands of people, I have to imagine there's still some like, am I really doing this? Like, when are they going to find out I'm a fraud up here? Like, does that ever?
Oh yeah.
Like,
oh, totally. Yeah.
Did you feel more comfortable in the US or in Europe? On stage.
I think in Europe, just because I had been with them, like I had already done, that first run with the guys in I Prevail. And, so I was more comfortable with the band and just with the performing environment. And, there is a level, I feel like, where you hit with a crowd where, it's like you can't keep track of like what's bigger at certain points. And a lot of the shows in Europe were all festival dates. So a lot of the shows were massive outdoor, you know, those sort of, like you said, sea of people type crowds. And I feel like it's almost like less intimidating it's more intimidating, like I don't know. It's weird. It's like from a performance standpoint, it's less intimidating, but, I was very in my head, more, I would say, on the first run I did with them. In Europe, I don't know why, I just felt a little more comfortable with the setting. I think the crowds too in Europe are very receptive to metal, and like, dude, there were some sets we'd play where like, even in the ballad songs, there would be Wall of Deaths and like mosh pits and stuff going on. Like in songs that like aren't even heavy, like they just go insanely right, like, hard over there.
Like Hurricane and it's
yeah. So I think that sort of reception from the crowd makes you feel a little more comfortable too, and a little more stoked, and you feed off that energy. So I was definitely more comfortable there, I would say.
Well, and if I'm hearing you correctly, you're saying that the US stuff was more like you opening, or you going with Godsmack, and then the Europe stuff was festival. So it was like people are there to see music, not necessarily I Prevail, but they're just there to have a good time with music. And then in US, it's a little more intimidating because A, it's new for you, and B, they're there to see you.
Yeah, right? Yeah. It was definitely different settings, yes, I would say, for
now,
sure.
Well, a pretty specific question. I think this happened in Europe. Nikolai broke this down a little bit for me. I did not realize that you had a special celebration on stage, even though it wasn't your day to celebrate. What was it like to have tens of thousands of people sing happy birthday to you on a day that wasn't your birthday?
Dude, that was hilarious. That show actually, that show was an anomaly as well, because when they were over there, basically every festival was like a rock and metal sort of festival, you know, like Download, Nova Rock. They're all like, you know, bands like Slipknot were headlining, Bring Me the Horizon. So we were used to like the, you know, backstage is sort of like all dirt and mud, and they're throwing hay down, and everyone's driving golf carts with the bandanas over their face.
Love it.
You know, everyone's wearing all black. There's tattoos everywhere. And somehow they got booked on this festival called Pink Pop. And that was that day. But it was actually like a pop festival. The headliners that day were the Red Hot Chili Peppers, One Republic, and Machine Gun Kelly.
Wow.
And I think Electric Callboy was booked on another day, and I guess they're like metal, but they weren't on our day. So on that day that I Prevail played, they were definitely the heaviest band. They were like the only metal band on the show that day. And on the stage we played, I think we played right after Gail, who is the artist that sings. There's like a big TikTok song, the ABCDEFU song.
Oh yeah. We played after them.
Yeah. So we played after her. So we were sort of like skeptical, cause we showed up and everything was like pink, and like, it kind of looked like Coachella, but like in the Netherlands. We were like, we have no idea how this crowd is going to take this. Like, are there even going to be people there? And then the show just ended up going off. There were insane mosh pits, you know, it was an insane crowd. And that was the day they did a pro shoot, and like it got posted on YouTube, and like it looked and sounded awesome. Like everyone there was super cool. But that was the day that, I don't know why Eric just decided that that he was going to mess with me. And
yeah.
yeah, told the crowd it was my birthday. And I just on the spot was like, oh, I guess everyone's singing.
Is that like, so it's not like a running thing. It's not that something he does often. It was just like, today is the day.
Yeah, he just randomly decided to do it on that show. And yeah, I mean, it was hilarious. Like, I'll definitely never forget that.
Amazing.
Was there like, kind of stepping back to just like your first few times on stage and stuff, was there like a certain moment you could remember that was just like a wall of emotion playing a song that you were a part of writing and stuff and just hearing that sea of people sing it back to you and stuff? Was there like a single song that you can pinpoint or like a moment?
I wouldn't say as much as a song, but there were definitely moments when we played Download in the UK throughout that set where that was definitely the biggest, most obnoxious crowd I've ever seen, I think, in my life.
Obnoxious ever.
In an amazing way. It was like, I just don't think I've seen that many people at like a venue in any setting anywhere ever in my life. So when we walked out there, it was just like immediate overwhelming. And I think just throughout that set, there were moments where, like you said, sort of earlier about the imposter syndrome where, you know, in a good way, like it was a positive thing. I'm just like, what the hell is happening right now? You know, like, why is this happening right now? Like, is this real? You know, and that set lives in my brain on repeat. I couldn't wrap my head around it days after we did it. And even now I think back and I'm just like, yeah, I still can't wrap my head around that show.
Something that Nikolai and I have talked about often is like, at least for me personally, I know Nikolai has a similar view on it. There's definitely fear going up to on stage and even the afterglow of like, I can't believe that just happened. I'm in my head about like, how did I perform, thinking about what it was. But the second that I hit a note on the drums, because Nikolai's in Live for Tomorrow, I'm in Midwest Skies, we're both still making music actively. I still have fear before, I still have fear after, but the second I hit that first note, it's like, I feel like I'm in the pocket. Does that feel similar for you, or are you like nervous along the way? Because you have multiple jobs, right? You're not just the bassist, you're also doing keys. You've also done a lot of producing and writing with them.
Yeah, I would say it's like that. It's like most of the nerves come before, and once you're on stage, you're just kind of that's sort of when the adrenaline kicks in and I'm just having a blast. I don't really ever feel nerves on stage unless something goes wrong, which has also happened. But and then you kind of get in your head and then you're like, uh-oh, like, and it kind of throws your set off a little bit. But normally I would say, yeah, once I'm going and I'm in the moment. A lot of those thoughts that you know, I have mid-set are usually, like I said, positive thoughts of just awe that...
Yeah,
I'm, you know, fortunate enough to be in the opportunity to play with them that I'm in. But I would say like first note is generally when things start to go smooth, you know, and you're just in it.
So before we like kind of retrace some steps, because I would really like to talk some of the early days too, because it's kind of surreal that a lot of this started with recording music in your bedroom closet. One of the things that I feel often when I'm playing on stage is like this, like, yeah, again, this out of body confidence that like, as soon as it starts, I'm in it. But like, are there any complications that you have felt being gone for so long, like internally, like with any internal monologue stuff, or has it just been... Because I don't want to pull you into a negative space if it's only positive, that's great. But like, even if you're not getting homesick, sometimes leaving home and changing your day to day can be overwhelming to the brain. And even though you're like experiencing so much positivity, you still can't pull it together. Did you experience any of that? Or was there just kind of this bliss while you're out?
I think to a very small extent, I experienced that. I think obviously you miss, you know, your friends and family and stuff at home. I definitely like miss my girlfriend and stuff. And, you know, you definitely get those moments of like, oh man, I just like, I can't wait to get home and like lay in my bed. But I don't think that it was ever something that I really had to struggle with. Also, I haven't, disclaimer, I feel like fully experienced tour yet. Just because the runs that we did have a short break in between the US and the European run. And they were fairly laid back in the terms of like, dude, some bands will go out and they'll, you know, and they've done this where they'll go out for months and months at a time. And you're just, you know, one tour after the next. And like, you don't even go home in between. You just like jump on the next one, you know? And I feel like Oh, for sure, man. And I have yet to experience that. So, you know, maybe that will change. I'm not sure. But so far, I feel like it was a good way to ease me into it. And I haven't really experienced anything that that was like super challenging in that sense, at least.
That's, I mean, that's good. Like I said, I'm not trying to pull you to a negative space. I just think, again, one of these things that I try to do with this podcast is just to use the overused phrase, try to make it like a safe space to talk about some of the unexpected negative sides of the creative pursuits, because people don't understand that like this tour that you got isn't just this like glamorous thing. It's something that you've worked almost your entire life to get to. So it's like 20 plus years of work for a couple of weeks of a glowing experience. It still doesn't feel like all of the work we've done has truly paid off sometimes, right? Like it's hard to appreciate something in the moment.
For sure, yeah.
But before we get into the upcoming tour, which I want to talk about a little bit towards the end here, or at least shows, the announcement that I just saw on social media that I'm really excited about. I do kind of want to toss it to Nikolai a little bit to talk about kind of our early beginnings, how we even first met, if you would be so kind, Nick.
Well, I mean, I'll kind of let John lead, because correct me if I'm wrong, were we the first band that you ever recorded?
Yeah.
Insane.
That's wild.
Insane.
Yeah, yeah. Live for Tomorrow was the first band, dude. I remember, I was just getting into recording. I had like written a few things on my own and sort of learned the basics of like how to record. At the time that I approached you guys, I was, I don't even know how old I was. I would have been like very young, maybe 14, 15.
That's probably about where like I placed it.
Early high school, if not late middle school, going into high school. And
I put it at the year 2013, right? That's when we recorded that single.
Okay.
Early 2013.
Okay, yeah. So yeah, I would have been like a sophomore or a junior.
I didn't realize you were so much younger than us.
Yeah. Yeah. And dude, I just remember I felt like I had reached a point where I was like, man, I want to like record a band, you know, like I want to do it. And I didn't know anything about, you know, the Northern Michigan local scene. I found you guys and I was like, oh, this is like Chunk No Captain Chunk, like the easy core. Hey. Like this is so sick. And I think I just messaged you guys and I was like, hey, like I want to record your band, like I'll do it for free. Like here's some stuff I'd worked on. And I think I reached just like cold outreach to you guys. And then you came over and to my mom's house and I had my little bedroom set up. And
I want to talk about that a little bit, 'cause we all grew up small town. Yeah. We grew up, if you're comfortable talking about the actual city.
Oh
itself.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay. Okay.
Yeah.
We grew up in Lake City and then you grew up about 20 minutes away in the middle of even further into the middle of nowhere, in my perspective, Houghton Lake, you know, pretty much same population. We had 1,000. What did Houghton Lake have?
Probably around that.
Pretty much
not a lot.
People don't get, like, when we say small town, a lot of people think like 10,000, even Cadillac, people think is a small town. Cadillac was the big city. Not like, it was like the big adjacent city.
That's where the Walmart was.
Exactly. Cadillac had the Walmart, so we got to go there. Houghton Lake had a Kmart. Humble beginnings, like where did music sort of start for you in general, even before you got into Live for Tomorrow?
Oh man, dude, this is such a crazy story, but I didn't even realize this actually until like probably like the past year. But I started thinking about like, what really did inspire me? Because everyone's got these stories of like, oh, this artist or this band, or my dad got me a guitar, like this is how I got into it. And for me, it was Guitar Hero. It was the game.
Yes. Oh, yes.
I didn't know how to play guitar. I knew like very basic piano, but I wouldn't even say I really knew how to do that. I didn't know any instrument until I played. My stepdad bought a guitar or Guitar Hero 1 and 2 for the PlayStation 2.
Love it.
And I remember playing those games and just like you know, for a whole year, I was just addicted.
Dude, that's like all I did. People talk about like how they're grinding Destiny or how they used to grind Skyrim back in the day. The amount of hours I put into Knights of Sidonia or freaking FCP Remix just to try to get those solos, man. Yep. They don't get it.
Dude, yeah, those games were insane. And yeah, that was what inspired me to I was like, all right, like I remember at the end of Guitar Hero 2, there was actually a they didn't have the rights to use the music, so they had to re-record cover versions of all the songs to put them on the game. And at the end of the game, there was a special like DVD on the PS2 version where they showed people in the studio like re-recording the songs. And I remember that was like after I had like learned how to play the songs on Expert or whatever, and then I saw that, I was like, all right, I need to like, I want to play guitar, you know.
Dope.
So that's kind of what got me into to wanting to be in a band or a musician or recording or anything like that was Guitar Hero.
Which is kind of funny because as an anecdote, like I started drumming in the sixth grade. So I was like growing up in orchestra band, but there was a drum set there. So if anything, I was learning how to play jazz, but I was learning how to play things technically. And then I started getting into Guitar Hero when it expanded, or sorry, it would have been Rock Band, I guess, when Rock the drum band, set first came out. And people were like, oh, David's a drummer. Come on and play the drums. But I would know how to play the songs on the drums, and Rock Band would get it wrong. So I'd be like, this is wrong. And I would just, I couldn't play the drums on Rock Band. So it was the exact opposite of your perspective with the guitar. Like, it inspired you to learn how to play guitar. I vowed to never play the drums on Rock Band again because, like, it was embarrassing.
Yeah, dude, it's tough. It's going backwards now and trying to play those games. I'm like, oh, this is actually way harder than like the real. The
especially real if you don't get like the latency right and stuff. It's just, it's all fucked up.
So, Guitar Hero leads you to get your first guitar, then, or was that keys? Or
So after that, my great grandmother bought me a piano, like an electric one. So I had that in my room, probably around the same time I would say that I was going through the whole Guitar Hero thing. So I started to dabble in a little bit of piano, nothing super serious. Like I couldn't really do the two hand stuff, but and
good
then,
at chopsticks.
Good at chopsticks, learning all the super basic stuff that you learn. My dad also had like one of them where the keys would light up and it would teach you how to play the songs.
Oh, sweet.
Damn. And then, I need one of those.
Yeah.
I want one. Yeah. They're pretty nice. And then, yeah, my grandma got me a guitar, which then after that, my mom got me a bunch of guitars throughout the years, of course. But that's when I started, you know, learning some of those Guitar Hero songs, Rage Against the Machine. Yeah, like, you know, the basics, the Seven Nation Army, all that stuff.
Were you listening to that stuff outside of Guitar Hero, or did you find harder or like punk or rock adjacent music through your parents?
It's a little bit of both. I think I was introduced to rock at a pretty young age through my mom and my dad. They both listened to, you know, one of the first CDs actually I ever remember owning was my mom got me like a Silver Side Up by Nickelback when I was like,
oh shit,
like just old enough to even have memories. Some of the first memories of music I have were that record. So yeah, I was introduced to rock at a very young age, but I think there was so much that I discovered through Guitar Hero, a lot of those classics. And it just like, you know, opened my mind to a lot of bands that I didn't know existed too. So that's like what really set me off onto the, you know, I was diving into bands like Avenged Sevenfold and, that was a big one for me, was that band. But like Slipknot and, you know, all those other like heavier bands, I guess, if you will.
Yeah, I'm bad with genres. I never know how to qualify anything. Just
yeah. But I dove into playing guitar for a couple of years until eventually I started getting into the recording end of things. But that was my introduction to music. And I think at that moment I knew that I wanted to do something with music. Initially I just wanted to play in a band, and I didn't even think about like recording or writing for other artists or anything like that. So that was kind of like, it's weird kind of how like I've taken like a weird around the block path, if you will, with everything. But my initial goal was to perform in front of people, and that kind of changed over the years. And then now I've kind of come back around and to the performing thing and am now doing it. But yeah.
I remember one specific thing was recording vocals in your closet with like a sock over like a metal coat hanger and stuff. And that, that stuck with me for a long time. And I, going back and listening to those vocals and stuff and just hearing how cringy I was and stuff is hilarious, but it's so nice to look back and, compare that to even just the stuff that, you know, we've worked on in the last year and stuff. Mm-hmm. It's super, the payoff's nice mentally, you know?
Oh, dude, it's awesome. Yeah. Yeah. I remember that. I didn't have a pop filter.
Correct.
And I knew that, like, I needed one. And, yeah, it was, like, a sock or something over, yeah, a coat hanger.
Yep.
And I remember I had like, a mic, like, in the closet. It was, like, a makeshift vocal booth. And then, yeah, I think, I don't remember if you guys just held it or, like.
I think Eddie was in there holding it.
Yes. Yeah. I was just going to say.
Yeah, someone was holding it.
It was Eddie was holding it here. He had the microphone like this and the hanger in front of it. And then there was, I believe, like an actual like rack where you'd hang your clothes. So for like comfort, whoever was in the booth would hold onto that rack, sing into the microphone and the sock. And Eddie would be like this, like turned away. Because, you know, spit.
Yeah, and I'm just like poorly screaming in his face. Like.
Well, and then we do gang vocals. But it's just John standing in the center of us with his hand up with a microphone in it in a room that doesn't have blankets or soundproofing or anything. And we're all just yelling in a circle around him. It was just, it was so good. And like, we talk about you being young. I mean, we were still young too. I think we were, I mean, two of you were still in high school.
I believe
two
me
of
and,
us were fresh
me and John
out.
Are the same age. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I, when I say us, I think Ethan and I, but I'm also a fifth year. anyways. But no, I didn't realize that you were like, I don't know, so inexperienced, I guess, at the time, because we saw that as like, dude, this guy, like, it can mix and produce. We couldn't. So already that was like, this guy's got his shit together and he's going to do it for free. And it was better than anything we had at that time. So,
yeah,
you know, you blew our minds as excited as you were for that.
Yeah. At the time I was stoked, dude. Like those were amazing times. But looking back, yeah, I mean, like I had no idea. And knowing what I know now about recording, I'm like, oh, I had no idea what I was doing. Yeah. Like the coat hanger thing. It's like hilarious to look back on, but dude, yeah, that was just an awesome, fun time, I feel like, for everyone, you know, hopefully.
Go ahead, Nick.
I was going to say, and I'd stumbled recently on one of my old computers, like that actual Purge EP that you did and stuff. And that was still, even for his time, that was damn good. Like for not knowing a whole lot about mixing and mastering stuff, it sounded great.
Well, I remember hearing.
Thanks, dude.
I remember hearing right after we released Underway, you wrote a riff and sent it to us and was like, I think this would be great for a Live for Tomorrow song. So we used it as promotional material for like new Live for Tomorrow music. We're going to make music off of this riff. Yeah. And then like two months after, that's when I left the band. But, and then, I mean, Nick could take it away very cyclically. It did end up getting used, correct?
Yeah. I think we used it in the Growing Pains EP. I think the song was called like Denial and Error or something. Like we finally used that little chunk, but.
Just like nice. After so much time, the fact that like, I mean, I pull old riffs and old ideas and old lyrics that I wrote like 10 years ago that I'm like, oh, finally, I found a thing for it. It's cool to know that like at the time, while we're all in our early beginnings, it got thrown on an actual album for Live for Tomorrow. Sweet.
Yeah, that's awesome. Yeah.
So post recording with us, how did things kind of take off from there? Like what was your next project? Was that the start of a portfolio for you?
Yeah, sort of. That was the first thing that I had that wasn't something of my own that I was able to put in a portfolio. I think after that, I didn't really work with other artists for a while. I sort of focused on writing and recording just like my own ideas. And there were two Facebook forums. There was one called the Joey Sturgis Tones Forum and one called the Chango Studios Recording Forum.
Chungus.
And Yeah. And shout out to both of those, because I don't know what I would be doing if it weren't for those. But it was a bunch of like-minded people that were, some of them were just bands, artists trying to find producers to work with. Some of them were producers trying to learn from other producers. It was just sort of like a knowledge music community thing. And I found a singer who I just sort of posted a bunch of instrumental stuff that I had recorded and produced in there. And I found a singer from Florida named Zeke, shout out Zeke, that I ended up basically joining, like, I guess my first sort of serious project that was a Florida local band called Lost Cause from Florida. So that was like the first thing that I did and sort of joined in, was a part of. And I flew down there and like shot a music video and recorded like a few songs with them.
So to be clear, you went from being in no live bands, no making no music with groups, to then being flown out to Florida to make, or sorry, maybe not being flown out. Did you fly yourself out? Okay, okay.
Yeah, I flew myself out. Yeah,
okay,
yeah.
Okay. All right.
Yeah.
We're still in the humble beginnings. I forgot.
Yep.
Fly yourself out.
Yeah, so.
To make music.
I flew, yeah. Yeah, yeah. So, yeah, I met him online. We worked on stuff online together beforehand and talked on the phone a bunch. And he would basically just like record himself and write over instrumentals that I'd made, and we'd make demos. And then when we got stuff that we were excited about, he had other friends that were writers and were part of the band. And he was like, hey man, like I've assembled a band down here. It'd be awesome if you could like fly down and be a part of this. And I was just like, yeah, so.
Cool.
That was like my next adventure after that. Still, I had yet to, like I said, I think between working with Live for Tomorrow and recording that song with you guys, and there was a long period after that where I didn't work with other artists for a long time, actually. I was trying to pursue the band thing. And then, yeah, that band ended up sort of dissolving because there was another band, a bigger signed band called Down and Dirty, that was on Sumerian Records, that actually lost their vocalist. He ended up leaving that band to join another band called Asking Alexandria. And
never
sort
heard
of got like a, yeah, so he got like a promotion there. And then the singer for our band was discovered by the remaining members on the internet, and they were like, hey, we want you to potentially be our singer. So at that point, the project sort of dissolved. And then that led to another project that I ended up being involved in. And yeah, there was a long chain of events after that. But that was sort of like the next step for me as far as getting into getting connected with people in the music industry and just trying to do the damn thing, I guess, if you will.
When you like start getting in contact with people who are a part of actual record labels, is there like, because I remember early days for us, it was like, get on Victory, get on Victory, get on Victory, we could do it. And then there was that A Day to Remember blow up, and then it was like, no more record labels, no more record, no, what do we do?
Yeah.
Like, so what was your perception of like getting involved with the actual industry? Was it something that you were like, yeah, like naive, like excited, I'll do whatever if it means being part of a band, or was there like cautious skepticism?
Oh no, 100%. I was all in the naive boat.
Okay.
I would have done, you know, anything to be on a label or signed. And you know, at that time when like even when I started working, yeah, with like signed projects for the first time and meeting these people in A&Rs at labels, it's like, yeah, I was just super all in, whatever they said I would do, you know. And that could just, you know, it could have been a horrible deal, who knows.
Yeah.
But I would have been down for it. And I think a lot of young artists can relate to that, because yeah, when you're just young and hungry, you tend to like want to ignore the potential risks just based on like the sheer excitement of being, you know, oh man, we could be a signed band, we could be touring, without thinking about, I guess, like what potential, you know, what that actually means. Not that it's always bad. I'm not going to sit here and be like, oh, like, you know, it's all
well,
bad.
And because
it's all,
the flip side of that is that, you know, we grinded the hell out of our careers, and I still feel like obviously there's a lot of room for growth, but I wouldn't have had it sort of any other way. That like blind naivety is the only reason that I was like able to keep going in those early days. Cause like, what if? And I think mm-hmm. it's important to hang on to that too. Even when you find a little bit of success, it's just like, you know, you gotta be careful. You gotta have your walls up. Some of these, you know, the record labels or the corporate organizations are going to try to give you the shit end of the deal, but like, you should still pursue that, you know, it shouldn't stop you. But sorry, I have a habit of interrupting. Yeah. Go ahead.
No, you're good. Yeah, I would say that not every label is necessarily out to be the bad guy either. There are a lot of great people that truthfully believe in their bands and offer them good deals. And you know, I know a lot of great relationships between bands and labels. But on the flip side of that, like you said, with the whole sort of victory thing, I've also heard some horror stories and lawsuits and things like that where, you know, bands get wrapped up in these year-long wars with these labels, and that stuff's, you know, what you want to try to avoid. But
so once you got past that initial like recruitment phase where everybody's like pulling you from different directions, you finally feel like you're establishing yourself, what is your first like steady, like, I don't know if you like signed contracts with bands, but like you became regular producer or a regular writer, what was your first steady source of creative?
Yeah, so that wasn't actually until very recently. So I feel like for a long period of time, I was trying to do the band thing, you know, wasn't working out. This band broke up, that band broke up, yada, yada, yada. Eventually, I reached a point where I actually moved from the Houghton Lake area, because I was sort of home-based there for a while in like the northern Michigan area, and then I was just sort of like bouncing around. Like I said, I went to Florida. I wouldn't say I lived in like the Detroit metro area, but I was traveling down there a lot to work with other bands and stuff. But in 2019, late 2018, I moved in with, like, I would say my best friend Nick. We've been living together. We still live together. So we've been living together for, shoot, it's been like 5 years now. It's been a long time.
Are you
time.
Saying that you and Nikolai are in opposite rooms of the same house right now?
No. Different Nick. Nick Matskos. But he was like a friend of mine that I had met through. I was in a band that he was actually in, Down and Dirty, actually. He was going to be recording. And we sort of developed a relationship, and he sort of taught me a lot about recording and mixing and mastering. And he actually used to engineer like early on for Joey Sturgis, who recorded, you know, bands like Ask Alexandria, Mice and Men, Attack, like all the Warped Tour, you know, all the greats, if you will. And Nick taught me a lot. And then we just hit it off, became really good friends. And when I moved in with him, we lived down in the sort of Detroit metro area together for a while. I would say that's when things started to become steady. The first artist, if you're asking as far as like which band was sort of like the first established project that was like a client, like a long-term relationship type thing.
Yeah.
There was a band that I worked with called Until I Wake. And they actually weren't a band when I met them, and they decided that they wanted to do the band thing. And they were like, "Hey man, like we love your stuff. You know, we want to work with you." And we wrote an EP together, and they self-released the EP, and it did really well. And then they got hit up and approached by a couple different labels, and they ended up signing with Fearless Records, who they're currently signed to. And that was the first time where I feel like I did something from the ground up and been like, oh, like, you know, I mean, we all did, but as a team, but Nick actually recorded it, mixed and mastered it as well. And I don't know. It was just the first time it felt like the team that we were working with had like done something from scratch and then like saw results, if you will. And it was just like, oh, this is awesome. And we still have a relationship with that band till this day.
Can I ask a quick insider question actually about that?
Yeah.
When a band is signed or about to be signed to a record label, does the label typically have producers and engineers that they have contracts with that they want their artists to work with? Or are they able to pull in like outside artists like you who aren't signed with the label, but you do production?
I would say it's a little bit of both. I don't know exactly how much contracts go into those types of things. That might be more of like a publishing deal thing. But as far as the labels go, they generally do know. They have a circle of people. And, you know, if you're a producer or a writer that's well connected with the A&Rs at the labels, they'll usually, you know, be like, hey, like we've got these guys. We've got these guys if you want to work with them.
Sure.
And they'll often make suggestions to the band. But Fearless was very much so like, hey, we like what you're doing and we want to just basically provide you guys the tool set to do whatever it is that, you know, you need to do to make the best record. And the band was very much so, you know, like, well, this is our team, and really, this is what we need, and this is what we really want to do, and these are the people we want to work with. And the label was like, awesome. Sweet. And so that was another good way for Nick and I to sort of get connected with, you know, the Fearless team, who is awesome. They've always been great, but that was a good way to develop a relationship with them, and the band. And like I said, it was like the first time that it was like, wait a minute, like, you can just take something, you know, and throw together a project and write the music, and like this can happen. Like, for me, it was sort of eye-opening, because I guess that's like what I'd been trying to do before, you know, with the other bands that had sort of failed, if you will, or broke up or whatever, I'd been trying to do for a while. So that was a pivotal moment. And I think around that time was also around the same time that I started pursuing music full time and was able to sort of, to be stable with the whole thing.
Well, and Nick, if you want to pick up somewhere in the middle, you guys got involved, correct?
Well, yeah. And I was just going to say, like, it's cool, like, after trying to get a couple bands off the ground yourself and stuff, kind of finding this space to where you can be a part of all these different teams and like get that same level of payoff, like, on the regular. Like, that's a really cool space. But sorry, what was the question?
Just somewhere in the middle there, you guys started working together again, correct?
Well, yeah, I mean, after just seeing you start to really find your own and work with bands like Attack Attack and all this big stuff, you know, you had just kind of always continued to be homies and send cool stuff back and forth. And I think we had, I'd say just pre-pandemic, wrote a LFT or LFT EP and sent it over to you to do some mix and mastering and stuff. And, you know, we had always tried to have this heavy influence in LFT, and long story short, we decided to kind of go a separate route and just start writing a whole heavy project and stuff. And John would come up to Cadillac and stay weekends, or we'd get an Airbnb down towards him and stuff, and spent the better part of a year working together probably on a monthly basis and stuff. And it was really cool to see the trajectory sort of form for the I Prevail stuff. Like, you had, you know, wrote with them before and stuff, and then all of a sudden, right towards the end, it was just like, hey, I think I just got an offer. Like, it was, you know, like, within a few days of the offer, it was like, it's just crazy to be adjacent to, you know, somebody up from Houghton Lake that sort of just is representing the Northern Michigan space. Like,
well, to pick up on that,
super proud of you.
Yes, I was just gonna say to pick up on that, like, it has been kind of crazy to watch. You know, and listen, I know to be on the receiving end of compliments, it's just like being sung happy birthday to. It's very uncomfortable. So I'll try to keep it brief. But also, let's be real, dude. We all grew up in the same town. We're all still doing the music thing with Nick and Live for Tomorrow, me and Midwest Guys, and you and I Prevail. But you've got to recognize that you're doing some pretty extraordinary things for a small town dude, right?
Yeah. Yeah, I guess so. Yeah, I mean, like... Yeah, I think there are definitely moments where I think about it and I'm like, wow, this is pretty crazy. You know, especially like you said, like, I remember, like, if it weren't for the internet, I really don't know what I would have done. But but thinking about those small towns like that and thinking about like how it felt, you know, when I was younger, like, what the hell? Like, how is this going to happen?
We were stuck.
Yeah, exactly. So when, in that sense, I feel like accomplished and it is pretty crazy, but at the same time, I'm like, I don't know. I just don't. Yeah. I don't know. It's, I guess to some extent, yeah, I could sort of recognize that.
I get it, man. And it's all about humility. And if you were here to be like, yes, actually, in fact, I am the best, and thank you for giving me my flowers.
No. I'm just a guy, you know, like, it's not, I don't feel, I feel like there are a lot of people who come from areas like that.
Absolutely. So I'll maybe rein it in. And instead of saying, it's inspirational, although it is, you just don't have to agree, it's aspirational in that, like, it is certainly not impossible. Yes, you got there in a really cool, unique way. Not everybody's trajectory is exactly the same. Like, the fact that Nick and I have had roller coasters on our own musical and video careers, and now it feels like we're finally at a place where we can make something happen with it. You know, did it take us till almost 30 to get there? Sure. But like, there's a long way to go. And again, we were talking about, I don't know if we were rolling at this point. If you look back 10 years at some of the shit that we were doing, we were cringing at it, thinking that, or we're cringing at it now, thinking it was the most amazing thing. So just this normal growth. It's just allowing yourself to say yes to opportunities, not turning everything down. And then, you know, being a little bit humble. But on that note, when did I Prevail start for you as a either client or a friendship, and then when did it become a more regular thing for you?
Okay, yeah. So so it became I was introduced to I Prevail by, there were some right after my last band that I was in. I was actually approached by two guys that sort of are from the Detroit area and had worked with I Prevail on their early stuff, like their cover, their first CD, and they ran a sync company. So it's like sync music is like background music for television ads or the, you know, sports replays or commercials and things like that. And they basically just had a catalog of music that they would collect and send out to these companies that would then use like these little rock or instrumental riffs or whatever. And they approached me because they had heard my portfolio of like instrumental music and wanted to work with me. So I did some work for them on the sync end, and actually had some placements on like some sports channels and just like random weird things. There was one that was like on a cooking thing where they were like making steak, and it was just like this little riff that I'd written.
Okay.
So I sort of got into that scene with them for probably around 2 years, I would say. After, because right when I met them was when I Prevail's first album, Lifelines, their first full length at least, had come out, which they had recorded and produced. And I worked with them for a few years. And then when it was time for their next record, they had approached me and said, hey, the band is, you know, exploring, you know, potentially working with other writers and trying to do some new things and branch out. And we'd love to have, if you're down, we'd love to have you try to work on it. And maybe just send over your portfolio. We'll get you on a call with the band and stuff like that. So I sent over my portfolio of like instrumental stuff that I'd done, which weirdly, I didn't think any of it. I wasn't sure what they would think of it. It definitely to me didn't feel like I Prevail music at the time. But that's what they wanted. They wanted to, you know, do something different. And yeah, they immediately liked one of the demos that was in the portfolio. And I got on a call with them and they were stoked. And then I actually went down to this restaurant called Mr. Z's down in, I think it's Port Huron area, and met with the band for the first time and the producer, and had lunch with them, and they were super nice. And so that was kind of how I got connected with them. And that song in that portfolio ended up turning into a song called Low that was on Trauma, their sophomore CD, so the album that they were working on at the time. And that was sort of my introduction to the band. And we did that song on that record. And then I didn't talk to them again for quite some time. That this was like right after we did that was when I moved. So then I was living with Nick and we were doing a bunch of projects together. And some time went by and I kept in touch with Brian, the singer of the band, and he had some side project stuff that he wanted to work on. There were some like small little things that that they wanted to do that were like also sort of sync related, like little theme songs for like podcasts and friends of theirs. And we'd gotten together and just like wrote a few things and connected over that and sort of like caught up. And then I would say we really developed a relationship and started working together on their following album, their newest record, True Power. Mm-hmm. I did a couple writing sessions with the band. This was the first time that I ever wrote with them in person, by the way. So on Trauma, everything was just like remote. Like I sent over ideas, they recorded the vocals on the idea.
Okay.
And that's kind of how we did Low. But as far as True Power went, that was the first time I had like been in the room with them. So I think we did a few side project things to sort of like test the waters and make sure the vibe was cool and things went super well. So then we dove into some I Prevail stuff and we wrote a song together, which ended up becoming Visceral on True Power. That was, I believe, the first co-write we did on that album together. And yeah, we hit it off, and we did a couple more sessions, and then they basically asked me if I wanted to jump in. They had already been writing with Tyler Smith, who produced that record. They had already started a bunch of demo ideas with him, and they're like, hey, we're already like, we're on a roll with this album, but we want to basically have you jump on board and help write on these songs and sort of like take it to the finish line. So they introduced me to him, and we basically just like assembled the team, and then they would go out and write with him, and I would work on stuff at home, and then we'd like, I'd drive out to them in Detroit and work on stuff with them. And that record was really when I would say our relationship started. That's when we, you know, all got to know each other creatively and personally and all those ways. And yeah, we spent, I think, like almost 2 years working on that, on and off, obviously, not constant. But I think it was like a 2 year process until the record was done.
Well, pardon my ignorance, but at this point, are they performing with a bassist and keyboardist, or no? Is it just split?
No, so their bass player left. They I think 2018 or 2019. So when Trauma came out, when they started that cycle for their second record, was when they were no longer with their bass player. They had a bass player before, and they parted ways with him, I believe, in 2019, I want to say. And then they did all of the Trauma cycle up until the pandemic, and through when we were working on their new record, they didn't have one. The new record came out. They actually did a couple tours without one. And then I went out to one of the shows on their headlining tour for the True Power tour in Detroit at the Fillmore. And that's when Brian was basically like, hey, man, like we're thinking about, you know, potentially having a touring bassist. And, you know, we would love to offer it to you.
Dope.
And I was just kind of like, oh, man, yeah, like whatever. Like, you know, and then here we are. So
was there any hesitation about like giving up some of the like work stuff for just performing, or was performing that like shining light that you wanted to get to anyway?
I think at a certain point I like pivoted. I feel like I was just always trying to be flexible. Mm-hmm. There was a period of time where all of the opportunities that were coming my way were on the recording and writing end, or like production end or whatever. And there wasn't a lot of opportunity for me to perform, nor did I have the experience. And it just felt like weird for me to try to pursue that. So I guess I just like focused on the production writing end, and performing wasn't even in my mind at the time. And there were bands that I'd work with that had offered me positions where they're like, hey man, like, you know, we need this or we need that. We need a guitar player or a bassist, or it'd be awesome if you came on tour. And I kind of just said like no to a lot of them. And kind of told myself like, if I work with the right band or the right opportunity comes along, I'll know. And yeah, as soon as I heard him say like, we'd love to offer it to you, I just knew. I was like, I have to do this. Like, yeah. This is something that I have to do. So, yeah.
Well, there was something that you touched on at the beginning. I'm not sure if it's something you can share or not, but you said something about something going wrong on stage.
I could probably talk about it. Yeah, there's just like little things that'll happen. I wouldn't say it's like something going super wrong. But I guess like when I'm performing, you know, if I like mess a part up, or there were a few nights where like my keys, and we have backups for all this, so our team was able to fix it quickly, but the keys wouldn't trigger, or like my keys weren't working for some reason. It kind of like in my brain, like the performance is going, it's going smooth, and then like something like that happens and you're like, uh-oh, like this thing is wrong. And I feel like it takes me a minute or at least a couple songs to sort of like get back into it, you know, because your brain is so fixated on thinking about it, even when it gets fixed right away. Or like I, you know, hit a wrong note in a pause or something and I'm like, uh-oh, like, mm-hmm. Yeah, all of a sudden I'm in my head now. And for the next few songs, I'm like just trying to be like, forget about it. It is what it is. Like, just move on, you know? So I wouldn't say
it.
Yeah, sorry.
Like David and I, I'm sure have done it in shows, rooms of maybe like 50 to 100. But like, I'm sure that feeling is only amplified when it's just on that grand of a scale.
Like, yeah. Yeah. It's, yeah. I mean, like, I'm sure any musician can relate when things go wrong. It's just not great. It's not fun. But I think that, the best thing you can do, or in my situation, the best thing that I could do, was just to tough it out and just keep playing. You know, if the keys aren't on, just keep playing as if they were, and then, you know, the team will figure it out.
Somebody.
And yeah, it's hard to get out of my head. And that's something I feel like I've gotten better at, and I've like practiced, is like, all right, like what are the things that I can do to not ruin my show if something like that happens, so I can still have a great set and like have a good time and not just sit there and living in my head the whole time after one little thing goes wrong. But little things like that, I feel like happen a lot, you know, little technical errors and stuff, but we didn't, luckily yet, I feel like I haven't experienced anything super catastrophic go wrong on stage. So I'm sure one day.
Is there anything notable that's happened on either run that's like the total opposite of that, like a very extreme high, like any like one singular moment in a set?
I mean, yeah, dude, we had a lot of awesome shows. Pink Pop, I think, was an awesome one. The one where they sang me Happy Birthday, just because we went on stage with a mentality of like, well, this is going to be interesting. I guess we're going to see what happens. Like, it's a pop fest. Like, they might just stand there with their arms crossed, or like they might run away. Like, we don't know what they're going to do. And so we just went out there with a very relaxed mentality, I think. And like, let's just have fun with it. And it ended up being awesome. And I think that just like got everyone super stoked. And I feel like everyone nailed that set. Everyone felt great about that set. And there were a lot of shows like that. It wasn't just Pink Pop. But yeah, there's a lot of great sets where you're just like on high and you get off stage and you're just like, that was awesome, you know?
I have...
Through your travels...
Well, go ahead, please.
I was just going to say, through the travels through Europe and stuff, what was the best food? Like, what country?
Oh, yeah. Man, dude. Dude, there's a lot of good food.
I'm sure.
I think France for sure had... Like, ooh. Paris had some insane food. We had a meal there that was insane. Where else? Switzerland had good food as well. Everywhere had good food. I feel like everywhere over there just has awesome. Everything just tastes different, you know.
Europe isn't packing all their food with garbage.
Yeah. A lot of it is, you know, the FDA here is a little more like, yeah, you can put whatever you want in your food, so everything over there tastes better. But yeah, I would say France probably was like the best meal that I had. And I know that they're kind of known for that, but yeah, it was really good.
Yeah, just seeing your stories like on Instagram all the time and stuff, it's like, it was a lot of sushi, which I was extremely jealous of. But I'm like, damn, that's probably like, for me, would be almost equal to playing the shows, is just
the food.
Just food touring. Like,
yeah, dude, yeah, the food was awesome. Yeah, dude, it was just really cool. That was my first time ever going overseas. I'd never been, you know, I've been out of the country, but it's like Canada. Like, does that really count? It's just kind of like,
basically Michigan.
It's basically Michigan, yeah. Exactly. So that was my first time overseas. And luckily, dude, it was cool because a lot of it being sort of a festival tour, there were a lot of days off in between that we ended up getting where, you know, we'd have a block of like 2 days off to where we could go do stuff. And yeah, like when we were in Switzerland, we got a small group of people together and we took like a train up into like this village that was, you know, super remote. Tiny, like maybe like 2 mile long. I don't really know how big it was. It was called Latterbrunnen. I might be pronouncing that wrong, but
there's about three Europeans listening right now who are so upset.
But it was unbelievably gorgeous, and it was really cool to just be able to play tourist and you know, see the Eiffel Tower, and that, I think that was like almost as much fun as everything else. It's part of the experience of just like traveling and trying new things and stuff. So.
Are you guys staying on a bus or hotels when you're out there?
Oh,
and stuff,
I saw a little teaser for something on Instagram today. It's what's the lead singer's name one more time? My apologies.
Eric. You're thinking
Eric.
Of, I think, yeah.
Yeah, he's going, I'm Eric from I Prevail, and this is our $1 million tour bus. And yeah. that's the whole video.
yeah. So on the US, that was our US run. So on the US run, they rented buses. For Godsmack, so we had two tour buses. We had a crew bus, which all of our crew and everyone goes on. And then we have like a band bus, which has our tour manager and like our photographer and assistant. And then the band goes on that bus. But yeah, buses both in Europe and here. The Europe buses are a little different, though. They're like double decker. They're the double decker ones over there, but it's weird because they're like smaller. So like the bottom, like both floors are just like you have to duck a little bit. They're like a little bit smaller, but there's actually more bunks. There's like six, I want to say 16. It was either 12 or 16 on the Europe one. Holy and they're God. All upstairs. And then there's like a little downstairs lounge. And those buses don't have like showers, so they're like a little different. And then the US buses that we had were like really nice. They had condo bunks, and that's the one that he did the video on were those ones. And there's like a shower.
Here's the
on
real
it.
Question:
like
how many toilets?
Just one.
Just one. And just is one there toilet. A no poo rule?
There is a no poo rule.
Good.
Yes.
Good.
You can't shit on the bus, dude.
Has anybody broken the no poo rule?
No, yes. As far as I know, no. But yep. I have yet to do it, but I've been told that this happens a lot, especially if you
maybe
get sick
this isn't
on the road.
Great fodder for the podcast,
diarrhea,
but there's an
the
old
night,
story
like,
of how
go.
I once used
but
a,
you have to do what they call hot
an old
bagging,
floor
where you basically
as
like
a trash can.
Put a bag
so what
in the toilet,
is I would
yeah,
take
and then
the rim
you,
off,
yeah, exactly.
And then I put the
you
bag
know.
In,
and then you
and then I put
you
the rim
know,
back
dispose
on,
of it or whatever. But I luckily have yet to do that. So
and I just got so violently ill one day that when throwing up through the trash can, it just punctured a hole in the bag. So then I was just throwing up into the floor tom. It's just accumulating like a puke bucket. Yeah, it's pretty rad. Well, away from the puke, back to music real fast, because I also popped the headphones in back when you were talking about the pop tour or the pop festival. One of the things that I remember that I've talked to both Nikolai and Ethan from Live for Tomorrow about this on the podcast man. With. It's those early days when you're trying to like be known or be seen or be recognized or just get the name out, the word out. Mm. People are very skeptical, right? Like you have to play a lot of these festivals where you're not very welcome just so people, you can hope that like three or four punk or emo kids in the crowd will see you. Like, and it's basically a decade of begging people to pay attention to you. When I joined Midwest Skies, Nikolai and I played a show with them 2012, probably. We got on a show with Hawthorne Heights, and we got to play with these guys. We were the only, like, more punk. It was more mm-hmm. like, I mean, there was, like, groups like Destination Morgue out there. I don't know if you're familiar with any of these guys, but they were, like, local-ish acts. It was more metal and then emo with, like, Hawthorne Heights. But we were the feel-good, like, hometown pop-punk kids, so we got along. And then for the next 10 years, I was, like, a fan of them. And then I got to join them when I moved out here to Grand Rapids, which was, like, again, an imposter syndrome and, like, full-circle moment for me. Because when I got to be on stage for the first time with them, people knew who they were. You didn't have to, like, convince people to enjoy what you're doing. People were there for that. Did you notice a transition like in your own life where you went from like essentially like begging these acts and these people to like pay attention to you to like, and I know we've talked about how I Prevail is the first one to like get you to agree to consistency, but like when did you feel, or do you even feel now, validated as an artist, like by outsiders, not just the peers, but the outsiders?
I don't know. It's tough to say that I fully even feel that way now. But I think because there's always going to be like the next thing, and you're always going to be hungry for whatever the next thing is. But looking back, I would say that there were definitely moments where I struggled more, with like finding work and finding artists to work with and, getting your work noticed, like you said, and it felt like a little more impossible, I guess, if you will. There were a lot of times it felt that way. I think the time when I when I stopped sort of feeling like it was impossible was sort of what I described with that band Until I Wake that we worked with, because that was the first time I'd ever like been like, oh my God, like we did something and there's some sort of results, you know. They weren't crazy, like, but there were results. And once I was able to sort of do music full time, I felt at least validated in the sense that like, hey, like I can quit my job and I can at least, you know, pay my bills and do this. And that means something. But I think even then I still felt like, you know, in this genre of music, especially and metal and rock, yep. it's not a super, popular genre. Like, and what I mean by that is, you know, you go to these like family get togethers or whatever, and you know, if you had to explain, you know, oh, like I worked with this band or this band, like a lot of them aren't even going to know any of those projects. So in that sense, it constantly feels like that, like, you know, you're not, like you're struggling in that sense. But, I think
one of the things that we experienced as Live for Tomorrow, and I'm sure that Nick can maybe shoot on this because he was the one receiving
it directly.
I
was able to go like, oh, okay,
we would
like,
always get this compliment.
You know, maybe,
like, man,
maybe I'm on something.
You guys
something.
Sound really good. I could do without the
but even,
screaming.
Yeah,
though.
Even now I just,
and it's
yeah,
like, you're always, especially while you're like trying to get people to recognize you. It's like, well, motherfucker, it's not for you. Like, I don't need you to tell me that shit. Especially because Nick was the scream, like doing screaming in the band, you know?
Yeah, yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, I mean.
Yeah.
Just in the business of making music to piss people's dads off, you know?
Yeah. Yeah, dude, it's tough, man. And I work with a lot of bands, and I feel like a lot of younger bands that are in that position where they're trying to just get their foot in the door. They're just trying to get their stuff out there. And some of them, you know, can have luck with, you know, Spotify playlisting or labels, or, you know, they can somehow, you know, wedge their foot in the door in that sense. But there's a lot of super talented artists that I know that are just some of like the most talented musicians I've ever met. And, you know, they still struggle. And it's like frustrating to be like, there's this insanely good band, you know, like you said, playing this festival or whatever, or they're putting their music out there. And for whatever reason, it's like not connecting in the way that I feel like it should. And I think I can only imagine the frustration that those artists have to go through with that, because it frustrates me, you know. And I feel like that's a tough thing for a lot of bands. And unfortunately, mm-hmm. I think that it's like you have to play the long game, because there is that component of, I hate to say luck, but I think that, you know, luck and timing and marketing and the other components of music that aren't just music and aren't just performance that are part of it. And the longer you do it, obviously, the higher your odds of learning how to navigate that landscape and find success. Like the odds, you know, go up over time inevitably, but it's tough, man. You know, some bands will grind for a really long time.
It's this weird dual perspective too, where like, especially people who aren't in it, they either have the perspective that it's all luck and that's the only reason somebody got there, or that it was just pure talent and the only reason that they got there is because they grinded as hard as they could.
Yeah.
But it's not. It is a combination of both. Some people get that lucky moment early and then peter off later, and then, you know, by, you know, 10 years into that lucky strike, it's over.
Yeah.
And some people have to grind their whole life to wait for it. And some people grind their entire life and wait their entire life and it doesn't happen.
Yeah. Yeah. But I think it's a combination for sure.
One more thing before we kind of bring this to some sort of natural conclusion, is that I've been kind of trying to gauge through the podcast, like, what is your capacity for dealing with mental health issues? Like, where are you at on your mental health journey? Is that something that you struggle with regularly, like all of us millennials do, unfortunately? Or is it something that you've always felt like you can handle?
I would say, yeah, I would say that there are definitely things that I struggle with on a daily basis. I think everyone has something, for the most part. And Yeah, I would say, like, as far as mental health goes, there's just there's always things that I feel like I'm trying to improve. I'm trying to think of like something that I think
there doesn't have to be specifics if they don't exist too. I mean,
yeah, no, I think the number one thing that I struggle with that I'm trying to like figure out and balance in my head is like inner anxieties. And like you said, sort of like the imposter syndrome thing. There's a lot of times where I'll go into a session and I'll feel incredibly confident and I'll be like, oh, like I'm going to go write a song with this band. It's going to be sick or it's going to be awesome. But there's also days where I'm like, am I even good at this? Like, why am I here? Why am I in this position? And I think that that's something that I definitely have dealt with, especially a lot more recently, where I kind of get in my head about those things. And I'm trying to sort of navigate that. And another thing would just be with more happening and more artists approaching me and hitting me up and such a busy schedule, is just like managing, you know, anxiety and time and trying to be as organized and do as much as I can, but still have enough time to like relax.
And so learning, I guess, like, time, when to say no, I imagine.
Yeah. Yeah. So like time management is another thing that, sort of like, I guess, stresses me out, if you will. And yeah, those are new things that I feel like I'm finding I'm dealing with as of recent. But the imposter syndrome one, has been striking up quite a bit, I would say.
And I feel like this is another duality thing in that, like, it's so discouraging to hear that everybody freaking deals with this thing. Like, it doesn't go away. It's really baked into a creative's perspective. But also, it's very encouraging to know that everybody deals with it. So, like, you know, it can still be a real thing that we deal with on a day-to-day basis. But if we're all walking around acting like frauds, but we all know it, like, maybe it could help us to be a little bit more vulnerable, you know, to, like, you know, this creative pursuit, whether you're a musician or a visual artist or whatever, it's tough as shit. And, like, you have to be extremely vulnerable. You have to take a ton of risks. You have to experience a ton of no's, a ton of failures, and that's why we all feel like frauds, is because we have heard no so many times and we're just chasing that one yes.
Yeah.
And then when we get that yes, we're like, are you sure?
Exactly.
Are you sure?
Yeah. Exactly, dude. So. Yeah, that's a perfect description, man. It's like, and I find like I can usually talk myself out of it eventually, but the fact that you have to have that conversation from time to time in your head is like, man, like, I wish I didn't have to do that. You know, I wish I could just be like confident, which I, like I said, there are definitely moments where I can be, but there's also those moments where you're just you can't believe it. Like you said, you're just like, are you sure? Like,
yeah, that's a healthy ego, though, is like not inflating yourself to believe like I deserve all of it. Where the hell are these opportunities?
Yeah.
But like, if you set your expectations, just one. Just one. That's all I want. Just one.
Yeah.
You know, then you can experience a good amount of validation.
In like all the shows you've done so far, like, is there any like notable, like, I saw you guys had, well, I'm blanking on the name, but no, dude from Bad Omens came up and did a song with you guys and stuff. Is there any like notable, like, holy shit, like, starstruck moments?
Oh yeah, dude, for sure. I think Disturbed was a big one. We played a show with Disturbed and Nothing More, and when we were in the green room, their bass player just came in, and I think it was just me and Brian in the green room, and he came in and started talking to us. He's like, what's up? I'm the bass player from Disturbed. And yeah, we got to meet the band, and like, dude, they're all just so cool and so nice. And nice. But in my head, you know, in the back of my mind, I'm just like, holy shit, like, you're Disturbed. Like, I remember ripping Stricken on Guitar Hero, like,
ah, yes.
Just, yep. I was just sure. Yeah, dude. Come full circle.
I just
circle.
Hit record,
yeah,
as like, you're like, circle. I remember hitting or ripping. I was like, yes, I want to touch that. Yeah. I knew it was coming up for more Guitar Hero.
Yeah. I think there was definitely a bit of starstruckness with them. Carrie Underwood.
Oh, that's what it was. Insane. That's
I saw all that stuff.
That was insane. That one too. When, you know, we met her, I was definitely like very taken back. Like, it's hard to not be, You know, you remember they're just people, and like I you know, I'm never weird about anything, but in the back of your mind, you're just like kind of like, oh my god.
But also,
was Carrie Underwood just like an organic fan of the band? Like, how did that?
Yeah, so she went on the first time she talked about them, I think, was on Good Morning America or something, and she had an interview about her gospel album that she was promoting. Yeah. And they asked her what she listens to. Like, what does Carrie Underwood listen to? She's like, oh, it depends on what I'm doing. And I think she said that I Prevail, she likes metal, and that she listens to metal on her workout playlist. And they like asked specifics, and she was like, oh, yeah, the band I Prevail, their Trauma album. And and then she kind of like made a disclaimer and was like, oh, but like, if you know, you're buying my gospel album, don't go out and buy that, because there's a lot of like swear words and stuff on it. But she said that she was a fan of the band on the show, like in the interview.
Amazing.
And
that's wild.
And then they went out to see her when she played in Detroit. Some of the band did, and they got to meet her and hang out at her show. And then she ended up coming out to the I Prevail show with Godsmack in Tennessee, and she just
that's awesome.
Came jammed. She was like up on the balcony just rocking out. Well, you know?
I remember seeing the band shared one of her stories that said like, I'm up in the balcony watching I Prevail, and I thought it was like a meme or like a bit. I thought you guys were like, haha, Carrie Underwood came to I Prevail. And then there was the following story was a picture of the band with Carrie Underwood, and I was like, oh my god, yeah. They even photoshopped her in. And then there was more posts. I was like, oh my god, this is real. Like, Carrie Underwood is
that was a cool story.
Yeah, amazing. So it turns out she's a massive, massive I Prevail fan. And
yeah,
she literally made it was pretty crazy. She like made the time to like come out to the show, watch the whole set, and then, you know, got to talk to everyone after. So that was insane.
Hell yeah. So, okay. I know that we were kind of cut it while we set that up, just talking about kind of starstruck experiences that you've had so far. I don't know how you won't be at this upcoming one if you're anything. I guess set it up. This next,
yeah.
Is this a tour? Is this a show? What do you got?
Yeah, it's like it's a couple shows, so it's like a mini little run. But I overheard it. I think it was like the first day when we were in the green room for Godsmack before we had played the first show. They were like, "Oh yeah, like we're doing this thing with Bring Me the Horizon," and I was like, "Who?" but yeah, so it's like three shows in Japan. One of them's like a festival, I believe, and then the other ones are just shows. Nice. But yeah, they with Baby Metal and Young Blood as well. So
it was Baby Metal. That's what I saw. I was wondering what the other name was.
Well, and Baby Metal's production always seems to be like crazy over the top. I mean, Bring Me the Horizon as well. Like, do you guys have like cool stuff planned as far as production goes for that show, or are you guys like kind of in that space where like you're limited?
I'm actually not sure. I don't really know what they have planned. I don't know what's in store. I know it kind of like varies depending on the tour and what's going on, but
and being across the entire globe is probably
Yeah, I know there's a lot of weird logistics with getting everything there and stuff. So I don't really know what to expect, but I'm sure, you know, yeah, like you said, I'm sure Baby Metal's going to have some insane an insane show. Bring Me Will as well. They always do, but
yeah, especially in Japan and stuff too. Like,
yeah.
Have you met?
I hope there's some like full show recordings.
Have you met any of the guys from Bring Me the Horizon?
No, I haven't. No.
Okay. So do you think that you'll have? And I know. Okay. All right. I get it. They're all just people. Whatever. Okay. But I remember hearing Chelsea Smile in the sixth grade and being like, there's an awakening happening.
Yeah, 100%, dude. Yeah, I think they're one of the sickest rock bands out there right now as far as like modern rock goes. And I don't know, massive inspiration for sure. So it'll be really cool to be able to play with them and maybe meet them or something. But I don't know. We'll see.
Hell yeah. So you know that thing's coming up. Beyond that, you said that you know there's some things that you can't talk about, but also there's a little break coming. What do you plan to do with the break? Is it going to be an experiment in independent creative music stuff, or are you going to just take an actual break?
So I have some writing sessions booked with a couple bands, and then there is a vacation that I'm taking, like a, I think it's like eight, it's like a week long vacation, basically. I'm going to the UP to just be with family. It's not like, I wouldn't say a family reunion, but there's a lot of family that are getting together and we're all going on like a big camping trip. So, I'll be doing that in the time off. And then, yeah, I've got like a couple small things booked with other artists. And then, that's probably it. The rest of the days I'll probably just take off to sort of relax before we hopefully do more stuff. So. Yeah,
I mean, you know that you will.
Yeah,
hopefully.
Yeah.
I hope this train keeps going.
Yeah.
Well, Nikolai, is there anything that you'd like to add before we bring this to some sort of end?
No, man. Just grateful to have you as a friend. And it's cool to see you have all these awesome opportunities.
I got something. We're gonna put you on the spot, John.
Okay.
Have you or have you not seen our short film?
Penelope. No, I haven't seen it yet.
Ooh.
I need to watch it.
Well, there's one more view we can account for.
Yeah, so you'll get that view. I'll sit down and watch it. I see the poster in the back, dude. That's sick.
Dude, it was so perfect. Actually, Nick, if you want to talk about this real fast, we met up recently to exchange these.
There's going to be a sequel at some point. He's sleeping right now, but we got another little munchkin. So
nice.
Another little hairless cat.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Nice. Yeah. That's awesome.
Yeah. So Penelope's got a little brother. Nick came and picked him up around here so we could do a poster exchange and he could get the cat as well.
Nice. That's awesome.
Again, that's no really shame, but also we value your creative input, and you would be a guy that I'd love to hear your opinion on the sound design. Because that was, the most painstaking process creatively, but then Nick spent just as much time as we did making the film, mixing the sound. So
nice. Yeah, I'll definitely check it out. Yeah. That's awesome. I love people that just make art, so I'm stoked.
Hell yeah.
Speaking of which, I am insanely stoked to see the new Christopher Nolan movie.
Oppenheimer. I'm seeing it on Saturday.
I'm so stoked. Yes.
I was going to say, I want to go see it in IMAX too. Have you seen how they have to theaters need to extend their actual IMAX reel just to fit that film?
Yeah, the 70 millimeter. Yeah, I got tickets I didn't buy them until yesterday. So I got tickets on Wednesday next week. And it's one of the last showings, but it's the 70 millimeter IMAX.
Yep.
So I'm so stoked.
God bless Christopher Nolan for being one of the last bastions of 70 millimeter IMAX film, shooting on film.
Yeah.
I know nothing about film production, when it actually comes to shooting on film, but I know how it looks and I know that Christopher Nolan is the best at it. Yeah. And I will pay any amount of money to see any of his films. Back to back to back, seeing Inception and then Interstellar, and now coming up. I did miss Tenet. I gotta be honest, I missed Tenet.
Well, I will say it's amazing, but it's not his best work.
Yeah, so. That's what I've heard. And I unfortunately let the reviews get to me, and I was like, but Christopher Nolan's perfect. And people are like, well, if you have that view of him, then I wouldn't watch this one. So I just haven't. I don't know.
It's worth a watch. I think Tenet's awesome, but it's one of those things where it's nothing he can do is bad. You know what I mean?
Sure.
But it's if you really had to rank, I don't know. It's a good movie. I'd say watch it.
To be fair, I watched Inception. Inception is the only, or sorry, not Inception. Interstellar is the only movie I've watched multiple times in the theater, and I watched it 5 times in the theater. Just because every rewatch was remembering something from the script and then just having my mind blown over and over and over again. So
I just showed Sabrina Interstellar for the first time, and I caught things that I didn't catch in my 7 or 8 other watch throughs.
Such a good film.
It's life changing.
I can't wait to see he actually was able to sanction the explosion of a nuclear bomb for film. I can't wait.
Yeah.
Because he's very anti-CG. He tries to do everything practically. So I suppose we'll see.
Yeah.
All right. With that, anybody else got anything? Anything? I know we've talked a lot about stuff you have coming up. Anything you want to plug? Any recent projects that just came out that you want to shout out?
Not really. I don't know. I just worked on a song with the Ghost Inside that came out a week ago.
Nice.
It's called Earn It. That song's sick. So I guess I could plug that. That was like my most recent thing. But
sweet.
Yeah, I don't know. Awesome. I'll be playing with I Prevail at Soaring Eagle on Saturday or Sunday. Sorry, Sunday.
Sweet.
So that'll be fun too. But
right, because you're saying Saturday you're in Chicago, correct?
Yep. Yeah, Saturday and Sunday we're in Chicago. Yep.
I'm not going to promise on air that I'll make that, but that is that's close enough for me.
Is it sold out yet? Or?
No, it's not sold out. I think the lawn just sold out, so I think you can still get like seat tickets, but yeah.
All right. Well, then we'll be in touch about it. Nikolai?
Mount P isn't that far.
Nikolai, besides Penelope, which you should go check out, youtube.com/@DavidJMund. Anything else you want to throw out there, Nikolai?
Yeah, I mean, I've been dropping a lot of content from a couple festivals that I just shot and stuff. A lot of new shows coming up, so just check out the Lafer Visuals page. Just doing a lot of music-based photography and video stuff coming up. So.
Love it.
Yeah.
And we are still in the process of recording the EP for Midwest Skies, but right now the single that we have out, Come Back For Me, the music video, in the link description, or in... whatever. Fuck it. You know what I'm trying to say. Click the link in the description to our damn music. Stream it on Spotify. Midwest Skies, I Prevail, Live For Tomorrow. Hey, thanks for doing this, John. This was pretty rad.
Yeah, yeah, of course, dude. Thanks for having me.
Just hang out on the line for a second so we can give you a proper goodbye. But as far as the podcast goes, thank you for tuning in, and we'll see you next week.